Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Standard Time, and we have some lines open for you if you'd like to call in with any question you might have about the Bible or Christianity or any alternate viewpoints from those of the hosts you'd like to express here on the program. Feel free to do so. This is a good time to get in. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And we're going to go to the phones right away and speak to Rashad, who's calling from Elmont, New York. Rashad, welcome to The Narrow Path. Good to hear from you again.
How you doing, Steve?
All right. Thanks.
All right, good, good. This is my question today. And I'll take it off the air. Biblically speaking, what does from what you can gather from the Bible, what does God consider a virgin?
What does God consider a virgin?
Yeah, a virgin, yeah. And I take it off the air.
Okay. Okay, appreciate your call.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye now. I wish you were able to stay on here a little longer because I'm not sure what the nuances of the question are. To me, the word virgin, I guess you're probably thinking about the term as it's used in Isaiah 7:14, where it says, "The virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel," which is, of course, a prophecy that the New Testament quotes as being about Christ. Modern scholars, many scholars, have pointed out, not just modern ones, but older ones, that the Hebrew word for virgin in that passage is the word alma, in Hebrew, which means, well, it can mean simply a young woman. And therefore, there are those who have argued that virgin, when applied to the virgin birth of Jesus, should not be thought to mean what we call a virgin, but simply a young woman. When it says a virgin shall conceive, or the virgin shall conceive, they understand that to mean merely a young woman shall conceive. And that wouldn't necessarily mean that she does so miraculously without the intervention of sexual relations. There's several problems with this. For one thing, when the Septuagint was translated, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translated by 70-something Jewish scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, this was translated almost 300 years before Christ. And therefore, it was not influenced by any Christian ideas or Christian teachings. But the Jewish scholars who translated Isaiah in the Septuagint, Isaiah 7:14, when they came to the word Alma, they translated it as Parthenos in the Greek. And Parthenos is a Greek word that means a virgin. Now, it may be true, or at least it is argued, that the Hebrew word Alma in the Old Testament prophecy could mean a virgin or simply a young woman. But the Jewish scholars, certainly not influenced by any Christian ideas, because Christianity had not come along yet, and they were not Christians themselves, obviously, when they translated the word Alma, they chose the Greek word Parthenos, which means a virgin. And therefore, they apparently understood the word Alma to mean a virgin. Now, we could either deduce from this that they knew the Hebrew language of their time better than we do, which is very possible. Or it could be that they just saw reasons within the context to understand this Alma as an actual virgin. In my understanding, although it is true that Mary was a virgin, and we'll talk about that in a moment, when Jesus was conceived, the prophecy doesn't say a virgin or a young woman. It says the virgin shall conceive. And in my understanding, the virgin is a reference to Jerusalem. That is to say, a child will be conceived and born in Jerusalem. Now, it might seem a strange thing for us to deduce that, or for me to conclude that. However, Jerusalem is referred to as the virgin in later on in Isaiah. And now I'm trying to find the particular passage. Here it is, Isaiah 37:22. In Isaiah 37:22, Hezekiah was told by the prophet to send this message out to the Sennacherib and the Rabshakeh, the Assyrians who were besieging, the Assyrians who were besieging the city of Jerusalem. And the message to Assyria was, this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you and laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head behind your back. Now notice, the daughter of Jerusalem means, of course, the people of Jerusalem in the figurative language of the poet. And the people or the population of Jerusalem is referred to as the virgin, the daughter of Zion. Now, the virgin, not a virgin, but the virgin. And in Isaiah 7:14, the virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. And therefore, I believe it's simply a prediction that a child will be born in Jerusalem. And actually, the first fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14 was in the birth of Isaiah's own child in Jerusalem. In the next chapter, Isaiah 8 makes it very clear that the birth of Isaiah's child was to be recognized as a fulfillment of this. However, the New Testament sees a second fulfillment of this in the Virgin Mary. Jerusalem, that produced the Messiah, is now represented by the antitype, the Virgin Mary, who brings forth the Messiah more personally. And so Matthew chapter 1 quotes this passage from Isaiah with reference to Mary the Virgin becoming a pregnant virgin without having had sex. It says in Matthew 1:22-23, so all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. So Matthew, the inspired apostle, sees a secondary fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14 in the actual virgin birth of Jesus. And again, the word parthenos is used here in the Greek, which means a virgin. It does not mean a young woman. Furthermore, I would point out that even if there was some question about the meaning of parthenos, which I do not believe that there is, if you turn to Luke chapter 1, it says that Mary was, in verse 27, a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph. Now, this means they were not married, betrothed only, and therefore they had not had sex together. It says the virgin's name was Mary. Then an angel came to her and told her that she was going to become the mother of the Messiah. But it says in verse 34, Luke 1:34, Mary said to the angel, how can this be since I do not know a man? This is in the Hebrew idiom, a statement meaning that I've not had sex with a man. And the angel explains that this will be a supernatural conception that will not involve a man. So even if we had some question about the meaning of the word parthenos or virgin in the passage, Mary herself says that she has not had sex with a man. And she's not lying. She couldn't get away with that talking to an angel. So if the question about what is a virgin means, you know, is Mary a true virgin based on the Hebrew word Alma, then I think I've covered that. Now, you might have had an entirely different question in mind. You didn't stay on to explain, so I'm not sure. But you may be thinking of 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul talks about virgins remaining virgins or choosing instead to get married. And he does talk about a man's virgin, meaning, the meaning of it is rather unclear in the passage, but some understand it to mean a man's virgin daughter, and some understand it to mean a man's virgin fiancé, because Paul talks about the value of staying single for the sake of being separated unto the work of God, as opposed to getting married and being tied down with what he calls, you know, the things of the world. But he says, if you think you're not being fair to your virgin by remaining single or by depriving her of marriage because the groom has decided to be more spiritual to remain single, if you're being unfair or you feel that you're being unfair to your virgin, then, let me read it here if I could. It's 1 Corinthians 7:36. 1 Corinthians 7:36, but if any man thinks he's behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she is past the flower of her youth, and thus it must be, let him do so what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and has so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. Now, this sounds here that he's talking about a virgin to whom one is betrothed. So it's the betrothed husband of the virgin that it seems to be addressing. But then it seems like it addresses her father in verse 38. So then he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. And so I would say a man's virgin sounds like it could be his virgin daughter, whom the father either gives or does not give in marriage, or the virgin fiancé. Technically, I would say the two verses that actually use the word virgin, though, seem to be talking about the man who was going to marry her. So it would mean a virgin fiancé. The reference to the father, he who gives her in marriage or he that does not give her in marriage, that seems to be the father of the girl. It does not refer to her as his virgin. It just refers to her as her. So I'm thinking that the word virgin in that passage refers to a virgin woman to whom a man has become betrothed, and now he decides that he would like to remain single. Well, he can support his virgin to remain in her father's home and not marry her, or he can marry her, Paul says. And he says that it's kind of a toss-up, although he thinks that staying single has advantages that Paul himself realized in his single lifestyle and highly recommends it to those who can do so. Let's talk to Dennis next from Salem, Oregon. Dennis, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I have two questions, if I might. I think there's an obvious answer to the first one. I hope you'll go beyond the obvious. Why did God create human beings in the first place?
As opposed to what? Just having animals? Or why did God create anything?
Well, yeah, anything's fine, but in particular, human beings.
Okay, well, I believe that God created human beings so that he might have creatures like himself in his universe, creatures that he could have as children, creatures that he could have essentially a family. I feel like God's motivations in this were not very different from the motivations of a man or a woman, or man and woman who are married, who wish to have children and have a family. In fact, I think that that instinct, which is in people, is no doubt part of that image of God in them. God, they have some likeness to God in the way they were created, and that likeness may include the desire to reproduce and have a family. So I believe that was God's reason for creating people. Now, of course, before he created people, he created a wonderful universe and all kinds of beautiful plants and intriguing animal life. And it was after all these things were already in existence that we read of him saying, now, let's go a step further. Let's make man in our own image and in our likeness, and let him have dominion over the animals and the birds and the fish and so forth. And so it sounds like, although God had made many beautiful and wonderful things before he created man and woman, he was not satisfied. He wanted something more. Animals are not the same as people. Plants are not the same as people. You know, you can have get a lot of enjoyment in horticulture or zoology or having pets or whatever, but he wanted to have children, I think, and that's why he made man and woman.
Why did he need to have so many?
Why did he need to have so many?
Children, yeah.
I don't know. They're valuable. Wouldn't you like to have a lot of valuable things?
Well, I'm talking about billions and billions.
Yeah, I know. That's wonderful. Even a man, biblically speaking, even a man is blessed to have a lot of children, the Bible says. And, you know, it says in Psalm 127, children are a heritage from the Lord, and they're like arrows in the hands of a warrior, and happy is the man who's got his quiver full of them. So children, human beings are valuable things because they're made in the image of God. And I suppose if someone said, how many gold Krugerrands would you like? You might say, well, what's the limit? I'd like as many as are available. And yet human beings are worth far more than Krugerrands, so I imagine that probably explains why God wanted so many.
Okay, my final question is, can you give me the name of a Bible that does not need a preacher or a scholar translate without figurative speech and everything else that you need a scholar so you can read it and understand it in English, plain, and say what it means and not mean something else when it uses an English word, like the example you gave with the guy before me. So many words didn't mean what they meant. They had to have a re-examination of different translations and everything.
Well, you need to understand that when you translate a book from Hebrew into English or from Greek into English or from any language into English, you're going to at times have words in the original language that can have multiple meanings in English. And so it is a judgment call at times to decide which English word is intended or which English word best represents the idea that the Hebrew or the Greek word has. The scholars who translate Bibles usually have done a lot of research about those things and do their best to give the right English rendering. I think some of the best Bibles, well, as far as readable, understandable, and accurate, I don't know of a Bible that is better than the New King James Version, but there may be some that are just as good. I think the New King James Bible is quite understandable, but that, you see, no matter what English translation you use, there will be times when it will be helpful to know that the Greek word has multiple possible meanings, or the Hebrew word has multiple possible meanings, yet you don't have to know that. You don't have to know that in order to learn about God and about how to please God. Those are things that take you a little deeper into the meaning behind the text.
Well, let me point you towards my concern.
Okay.
I listen to a lot of radio. I drive a lot, and I listen to a lot of Christian shows, and they all seem to be fundamentally based on the speaker saying, essentially, you can't read and comprehend the Bible. I have to translate it for you, or we have to translate it for you, because half of the words don't mean what they really say in English, just like your example of the virgin situation.
Well, what I said was that the word parthenos actually does mean virgin, but the word alma apparently is questionable.
Yeah, what I mean is it has a very deleterious effect on people trying to read the Bible and understand what it says, because pretty soon you get the message that unless you've attended seminary or studied it for eons, that you're going to come out of it with all kinds of misinterpretations that have to be straightened out by somebody who can read it and understand it. And I have
let me clarify the issue, if I could. First of all, I think any good English translation of the Bible will give you the basic message of the Bible. There are no doubt some instances in each translation where the translation could have been more perfect than they are, but on balance, you'll get all the right information if you read any good English translation. But here's something to understand. I mean, it sounds like you're perhaps saying that teachers should not try to clarify the meaning of Hebrew and Greek words. And maybe because, you know, we're common people here, we shouldn't have to become scholars in Greek and Hebrew. Well, there is another thing to consider, and that is that the original readers to whom the Bible was written spoke Hebrew and Greek as their native languages. We don't. And so when they heard the Hebrew words, they didn't need to go to an English translation. They knew instantly what they meant. Or when they heard the Greek words, they knew instantly what they meant. We are at one disadvantage that they are not, and that is that we don't read those languages. And most of us don't. And unless we are going to actually learn to read those languages, which is very time consuming, it's valuable to have a teacher who can just point out the times here and there where the meaning could be, clarified.
I think that teacher, and all of them get together and put it together in a written form, and we don't have to listen to them to get it in a verbal form. It's 2,000 years now. You know, English has been around, 700, 800 years or more?
Well, English translations of the Bible have only been in print, of course, since the printing press for the past 500 years.
Right.
And for a long time, the King James Version was the standard English version among Protestants. And it was a good one. But in the last 100 years or so, maybe 200 years, there have been translators who've thought they can either improve the language because some of the language of the King James became archaic, or in some cases because new manuscripts were found, they thought that a verse here, a verse there could be now translated a little more accurately than before. But as I said, I mean, it's not really a problem. You get a good English translation and study the Bible in English, and you'll get essentially what the Bible wants you to see in virtually all the cases. The reason that scholars can't all get together and just make one translation that will satisfy everybody is because there are some differences of opinion as to which meaning of a Greek word is intended in a given passage. And so the scholars each, you know, represent their understanding of what they think the Greek word means in that passage, when in fact the same Greek word in another context, or even if the writer of the passage has something different on his mind, could have a slightly different meaning. But again, these differences should not discourage people. I got most of my knowledge from the Bible just from reading the King James Version through the years. Eventually I had access to Greek and Hebrew reference works and was able to do some study on that, which I found very enriching. But I was as good a Bible teacher as I am now before I had anything other than an English translation, I think.
Okay, so I still need to approach the Bible with a very scholarly demeanor.
Well, like I said, when you're studying something that's translated from a foreign language, a dead foreign language, because nobody speaks biblical Hebrew or Greek anymore, then, of course, that it is the realm of scholars to access those languages for us. So it's not that you have to become a scholar, but you do need to, it benefits you to access the discoveries of the scholars who work on those things. You don't have to become a scholar. Just read your English Bible all you want, and don't worry about the Greek and Hebrew if you don't want to, and you'll do fine. But, sometimes people do like to dig deeper, and if they want to, then it does require accessing the work that scholars have done.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Dennis, God bless you. Thanks for calling. Okay, that's a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and the phone number again is 1-800-438-5090. Seth from Hillsboro, Oregon is next. Hi, Seth. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, good to hear from you again.
So it looks like my battery's about to run out on my cell, so I'll try to quick and get off the air. So I have a homeschool question for you. My wife and I, well, primarily my wife, homeschools our son, who's 6 years old. And we get some resistance from family members and even at our church, people giving us basically the argument that children should be salt and light in their community, and so that taking them out of the public schools is removing their witness from the schools. And I'm not completely sure how to respond to that, other than the fact that I think as a parent I should be able to determine when my son's ready to go out.
Absolutely.
So I was hoping maybe you could talk a little about that and give me a little aid and ammunition.
Okay, Seth, thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Okay, talk to you again. I've heard this a lot because we homeschooled our kids. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. How many Christian kids who go to public school are indeed salt and light there? I mean, first of all, the public schools in many cases forbid any outright evangelization or proselytization and stuff, and in some cases the Christian kids are actually persecuted if they bring Bibles to school and so forth. Now, I don't think that persecution and challenges like this are necessarily wrong for Christians to endure, but let's face it, little 6-year-old kids, A, may not even have a strong personal faith in Christ, and B, even if they do, might not have any particular voice in the public school to present it, and they may not be strong enough to stand up under persecution and resistance. They might be. Now, when I was in second grade, I was taught evolution, and I had never been taught against it by my parents because I guess they didn't expect I'd encounter it that early. And yet I had read the Bible, and I told my teacher that, you know, this can't be true because the Bible says, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and so forth. And I the teacher did not challenge me on that. You know, I didn't even realize that the teacher would be aware that evolution is contrary to the Bible. I didn't even know it was called evolution. I just know that what they were teaching me didn't agree with what I read in the Bible, and I said so. Now, not every kid who's raised in a Christian home is quite ready to challenge their teachers on these kinds of things. And so, yeah, it's the father, you as the father and your wife as the mother are the ones who have the responsibility to decide when and if your child is ready to go into the public school system. You know, the point here is there's never a case in the Bible where any child was ever sent out as a missionary. There's not a recognition in the Bible of children's calling to go out and be salt and light. Now, it's true that they are a good example. If they are a good example, Jesus said, you know, you got to be humble like a little child. Fine. But he wasn't even talking about Christian children, necessarily. And when it comes to Christian faith, we have to remember that the public schools, many of them, are determined to destroy Christian faith. And it's, of course, a lot easier to send your kid to school. And I think a lot of people who make the excuse that you mentioned may simply be making excuses to not take the more difficult route of raising and training their own kids at home. I'm not saying everyone has to raise their kids at home, but I certainly believe that a parent is wise to keep his children at home until they're old enough to face challenges in their faith and not be shaken. And so, I mean, anyway, in some schools even, it is the case that if the child speaks up against certain social agendas, let's say they say, I believe that homosexual behavior is not normal and that it's sinful, there are some schools that will actually take the kids into some kind of sensitivity training and may even report you to social services as one who's indoctrinating your kids into intolerance. Now, I'm not saying that all schools do that, but there are schools that have done that, okay? I mean, most people listening might say, oh, our school would never do that. Maybe not. Maybe they wouldn't. But there are schools that have done that. And you just have to count the cost. You send your kid to school and you expect him to be salt and light. Well, you're doing something the Bible never, ever recommends or has any example of. And that's sending your kid into a pack of wolves or into a snake pit and saying, hey, you know, you're a Christian, be salt and light. Well, the children are by nature absorbing information and values from their environment. They are not disseminators, all right? If we're talking about a high school student, if we're talking about someone in their early or mid-teens who's a strong Christian, then by all means send them into the public schools because then they can have some ministry. They can have exposure to the world while they're still under the care of their parents. I think now, but I just talked to some parents on the weekend, 2 weekends ago in Missouri, who said that they had put their homeschooled kids into high school as teenagers and had had very bad results because apparently their child got persecuted and kind of backed away from his Christian convictions as a result. So, I mean, when I say by all means put them in public school, I would say if you are quite sure that your child is stronger in his convictions than his peers and his teachers will be in trying to destroy those convictions. A six-year-old, I would hardly expect that of them. And so I think your friends and family are simply being, I don't know, I got a feeling that people who aren't homeschooling, I'm not homeschooling anymore myself. My wife did most of the homeschooling. Most of my kids are grown. I have one child left at home who's a junior in high school, and he does go to public high school now, but he was homeschooled all the way through junior high school. And he's doing okay in the public high school, but having homeschooled four children, we knew all the arguments people bring up against it. And we often found people who, as soon as they heard we were homeschooling, they got very defensive and told all the reasons why they were not homeschooling. And no one had put them on the defense. It sounded to me like they were feeling kind of guilty. It seemed like they were feeling like, you know, if they were really good parents, maybe this is what they would do, but apparently they're not, or they feel like they're not, and they're feeling guilty and feel like they have to justify themselves. And I think when people feel guilty about not homeschooling, and I'm not saying they should feel guilty about it. Some people have no choice, or it's not the right option for them, perhaps. But when people do feel guilt about it, they sometimes come up with lame arguments like that one, very poorly thought out, obviously, in order to, you know, try to persuade you to not make the decision that they're not making. That is, so you won't homeschool because they don't. then I guess they could feel better about themselves. Now, a few people who say it might actually believe what they're saying. If so, they're simply, they don't know much about children, and they certainly are not thinking this through very well. But it sounds like you and your wife are, and I appreciate that. Thanks for your call, Seth. Let's talk to, well, Rashad from Elmont, New York, who's back with us. And we have lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. 1-800-438-5090. Rashad, welcome back. Did you want to clarify your question, or do you have a new question?
No, I'll clarify the question.
Okay.
Right. So basically, this is the mindset, I think, of a lot of people today, including Christians, is that they're a virgin as long as they don't have intercourse with someone. Now, that was basically where I was going with that.
I see.
As far as the Bible is concerned, what's considered a virgin? Is it somebody that has never had any kind of sexual contact with another person?
Well,
and including intercourse, or is it just plain intercourse alone?
Okay. Well, now the Bible uses the word virgin technically as someone who's never had intercourse. We have to remember that in that society, boys and girls didn't go and make out in cars on Friday nights. And, there were, of course, some boys and some girls who got into trouble, no doubt, but it was through intercourse. They didn't have the kind of culture where boys and girls just went out alone, unsupervised, and, were petting and things like that, short of intercourse, like sometimes happens today. So the idea of a girl losing her virginity in anything short of intercourse was never considered. I mean, today there might be all kinds of sexually oriented activity that is not intercourse that would perhaps we could say defile the innocence of a girl who is still a virgin. But I think technically she is a virgin unless she's had intercourse. And in that respect, much as I don't have any sympathy for what he did, Bill Clinton was probably correct in saying he did not have sex with that woman, because as far as I know, he didn't have intercourse with her. That doesn't mean that what he did with her was a non-sexual activity, and it doesn't mean that it was a moral activity or one that a married man has any right to do with somebody who's not his wife or any of that. I'm not saying what he did was okay, but just technically, it was not intercourse. And had Monica Lewinsky been a virgin previous to that, there's a sense in which she would still be a virgin after it, technically speaking. But being a virgin doesn't mean you're pure. Being a virgin just means you haven't had sex. A person who hasn't had sex may be very impure and may have a lot of purulent activities that they've been involved with that didn't involve intercourse, and that's not okay. Just like using pornography is not okay. It's not technically sex, and if a man or a woman looks at pornography, they're still virgins. It may be if they've never had sex, but that doesn't mean what they're doing is okay. But technically, I'd agree with those who say that a woman who has not had sexual intercourse is a virgin.
All right. Biblically. Okay, that clears it up for me.
Okay, Rashad.
Very much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Let's see.
Now, I want to clarify that if somebody says, oh, well, if we've just been petting or we've been doing other things that are not intercourse, that are sexual, then that's okay because we're still virgins afterwards. It's not simply that the Bible doesn't simply require people to remain virgins before marriage. It requires them to remain pure. And there's a lot of impurity that can take place short of losing one's virginity. And a Christian, certainly, needs to be determined to remain pure. Paul said in, as I recall, it must be Titus chapter 2. No, it's 1 Timothy chapter 5. Paul tells Timothy to remain, to act toward younger women with all purity as sisters. So a young man should treat young women the way they treat their sister, with that kind of purity. And if they don't treat their sister purely, well, then they're perverts, and they need to find another standard to go by than that. Let's talk to Eddie from Forsyth, Missouri. Hi, Eddie. Welcome to The Narrow Path. I got your package today, by the way.
Pardon me?
Okay. I got your package today, and I've already started using it.
Oh,
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. I was just wondering if I was listening to one of your lessons where you're talking about baptism in fire in the baptisms lessons.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you've heard anyone use that as a defense along the lines of the universal reconciliation, like the baptism in fire might be the period of time that a person spends in hell before they're ultimately reconciled and brought back to, you know, God.
Well, it's an interesting suggestion. I don't think I have ever encountered anyone using that argument, but I could see why, you know, if a person believes in universal reconciliation, I could see why that might be a way they would want to take it. I have recently picked up a couple of new books presenting the doctrine of universal reconciliation, which I intend to read, and maybe I'll find that some of them use that argument. But I have not personally run across it used that way.
Okay, yeah, because I was listening to the lesson on three views of hell again, and
uh-huh.
It was just a compelling argument when you spoke that some people figure if God is all-powerful and he doesn't want anybody to not be saved, that sooner or later, you know, when does he get to win? And and I could see if someone came to baptism or to baptize with the Holy Spirit and with fire, that those might be two ways that end up showing everyone a chance out.
That people either are saved through receiving Christ and receiving his Holy Spirit in this life, or else they're saved through the fire of a purgative sort of a hell.
Right. So I was just wondering if that was a view that had been encountered before or that someone might have used, if there were any arguments against it.
In saying that I have not encountered it before, that does not mean it isn't used or even commonly used by those in that view, because I haven't read that many books on that view. Actually, last week in Florida, I read through a very good book on that subject, which is called The Inescapable Love of God by Thomas Talbot. Have you heard of it?
No, not yet.
Okay, it's not cheap. At Amazon.com, it seems like it costs $25, and it's a small book, only 200 pages paperback. And, you know, it seems like, for what it is, it should be a little less expensive. But someone sent me the book, actually, and I'd heard of it, so I read it. And I thought it was a very good presentation of that viewpoint.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's called The Inescapable Love of God by Thomas Talbot.
Okay, great. And thank you again for the St. Louis meeting. That was wonderful.
Well, it's good to meet you and your family and to see your daughter be baptized.
Thank you very much.
God bless you, Eddie.
You too. Have a good day.
Okay, we'll talk again. Bye now. All right, we have a little less than 20 minutes before the end of the program, and our lines have just cleared. I have questions that people have emailed me, and I will take those in the absence of calls. But if you would like to call, like I say, we have close to 20 minutes left, maybe a little over 15. If you want to be on the program, you have a question about the Bible or a difference of opinion from the host, feel free to call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And while calls are now coming in, I want to give you a little information about what's happening this weekend. This Saturday, we have our regular monthly gathering in Santa Cruz. In a home, this is an open discussion, a lot like this program, only with more people involved, and it's face-to-face, which is nicer, too. And it's in a home, a very pleasant environment, so pleasant, in fact, that people don't even want to leave once they're there. It goes on for about 3 hours or so. But if you'd like to be a part of that, that's what it's for. It's for you, these gatherings which happen once a month in Santa Cruz and once a month in Salinas, once a month in Orange County, and a little less frequently up in Oregon. These are for our listeners to get together and meet other listeners, other people who, you know, who are looking for fellowship, who are looking for a higher level of biblical dialogue than they usually find at their Sunday school class. Whatever. If you'd like to join us this Saturday in the Santa Cruz area, we are meeting in a home in Santa Cruz. You can find information about it at our website, but if you don't have access to the web, you can call this number to get directions to the meeting. It's this Saturday night at 7, and the number to call, you'll call Mike or Brenda, The number to call is area code 831-475-8301. That's area code 831-475-8301. And for those of you in the Santa Cruz area, also every Tuesday night, we have a meeting in a home, a different home. And I'm teaching a study through the book of Ephesians. Tomorrow night is Tuesday night, so we'll be doing it tomorrow night if you'd like to join us there. There's also information about that at the website. If you'd like to call that place and get directions to that, that's for Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Our study in Ephesians, which is every week, you can call this number. It's called Scott or Rene at area code 831-851-0444. Again, that's area code 831-851-0444. Okay, that's if you're interested in gatherings in Santa Cruz this week, tomorrow night and Saturday nights this week. And if you didn't get those numbers but you want them, you can find them at the website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. And click the link that says announcements. You'll get the information you need. Let's talk to Gary, who's calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Gary. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I called you last week. I have a question for you. I was reading a thing, and I mean, have you ever heard of The Plain Truth by...
Yeah, that's from the Worldwide Church of God.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who the guy is. Something Albrecht?
I don't know the new guy's name. It used to be Herbert W. Armstrong.
No, this is another one called The Plain Truth, and it's something...
Is it a magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not Armstrong anymore. He's dead, and I don't know the guy's name who runs it, but The Plain Truth is a magazine that's been published for many years by the Worldwide Church of God.
Oh, okay. Well, they were talking about hell, and they had all kinds of different views on hell, and do you think that hell is just is to be taken as a literal place, or do you think that there's a... I was kind of confused after I read the article, and then I went to the library to check out a book called The Four Views on Hell by, his last name is Crockett, William Crockett. And I haven't read it, but I'm about to read it.
I've read it. I have it on my shelf. There are four views of hell. Unfortunately, that book, the fourth view that they present is really simply the Catholic view of purgatory, which isn't a view of hell. The views in that book, Four Views of Hell, are the literal view, where hell is literal fire for eternity and torment. The second view is the figurative view, where hell is not literal fire, but it is nonetheless torment forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the third view they give is a conditional immortality, which means annihilation. That's the view, as far as I know, that the Worldwide Church of God teaches. At least they used to. I'm not sure if they still do, because they've gone through some changes. But they have always, in the past, taught that people are annihilated after death if they're not saved. And they don't...
Yeah, well, the Jehovah's Witnesses hold to that view.
Yes, they hold that view, too. In fact, the Worldwide Church of God and Herbert W. Armstrong originally got that view from the Jehovah's Witnesses. And that view is presented as the third option in that book. The fourth view should be universalism or universal reconciliation, because that's a view that is out there. And on that view, hell is a place of purging. And after people are purged, they will come to repentance and be saved, so that hell is not eternal torment. It's just long enough to purge people and bring them to repentance so that they will all eventually be saved. That's the universal reconciliation view. And that is truly the fourth view available that should be out there, but the Crockett, who put the book together, apparently was not aware of that, and so he brought in a Roman Catholic as the fourth view and talks about purgatory. Now, of course, purgatory, the Catholic view of purgatory is kind of similar sounding to the universal reconciliation view, but the Catholics still believe in eternal torment for those who are not saved. Now, they just believe purgatory is a third option or a third place where people go who die not quite bad enough to go to hell, but not quite good enough to go to heaven yet, so they have to be purged yet. So the Catholics really hold the first view of hell, and by putting them in there, it was a mistake, I think. They should have had Thomas Talbot in there writing Universal Reconciliation or something like that.
Yeah, what was that book again by Thomas Talbot again?
Thomas Talbot. It's called The Inescapable Love of God. Now, when I recommend it as a good book, It doesn't mean that I recommend his thesis or agree with it. I recommend many good books that I don't necessarily hold to the views. I think Christians would do well to research many views that they have never heard before if there is a good biblical argument that can be made for them, just so that Christians will be better equipped to know, you know, whether their views are the best views around or not. That's something I've been doing all my life, and in particular, the last several years, I've been reading books that present alternate views of hell.
Mm-hmm.
And because I want to know what the different views are and what scriptural basis there may be for them. And you may be interested, if you have internet access, in my lectures, which are free and can be downloaded from my website. It's called Three Views of Hell.
Uh-huh.
And it treats the traditional view that hell is a place of eternal torment for the lost. That's the first view. The second view is the annihilationist view, or what's called conditional immortality view. And the third view is the universal reconciliation view. And I give a pretty thorough survey of the different biblical cases for each of these views, although I'm still researching it myself. I haven't really made up my own mind.
I see. Well, it's interesting.
Yeah, and when I say I haven't made up my own mind, I want to make it clear that my mind was indeed made up for the first 20 years of my ministry or so. I had no question about the traditional view. It's just that I've read the biblical case for other views and found out how many Christians throughout history, I mean, mainstream, intelligent, godly Christians, have held some of these other views. It made me sit up and take notice and begin to research them.
Yeah, I see. Okay, well, I guess that's really all I need to know, but thank you. I appreciate your information.
All right, Gary. And by the way, the Worldwide Church of God used to be a cult. That is, they used to be regarded as a cult, but they've had some major changes now, and although I might not believe everything they believe, I think they've become a reasonably good group of Christian people.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Steve.
All right. God bless you, Gary.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay. We've got just 6 minutes left. If you want to join us, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And I received this email today. And I wrote back a partial answer to it, but Nancy wrote, and she said that a friend of hers has these questions, and one of them is, I think her friend said, the pastor says that the author of the book of John is John the Baptist, which makes sense when you read the book. He says, okay, my Bible notes say that the book was written by John the Apostle, so how, you know, who's right about this is basically what the question is. I'm summarizing a long paragraph. And basically, just for the person who's confused about this, the pastor who said that John the Baptist wrote the book of John is mistaken. He's confused. There's no way that John the Baptist could have written the book because the book records the whole life of Jesus, including his death and resurrection. And John the Baptist died in prison before Jesus died and rose again. So, of course, John the Baptist couldn't have written that book, and no one has ever believed that he did. It's John the Apostle, the son of Zebedee, the brother of James, one of the top three apostles, one of the four fishermen that Jesus called. That's the man who wrote the Gospel of John and the Epistles of John and the Book of Revelation, in at least conservative people's views, and in my view also. Okay, let's talk to Sue, who's calling from Salinas, California. Sue, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I heard on Friday, and there was a lady telling you about a nice book for to understand about Islam, and she told you it's by Mark Gabriel.
Okay. Uh huh.
Okay. And I read his book, and it's very good. And I read more books for him. It's a good English, and explained very clearly about that. And I'm calling you now to tell you there is a website, www.islamexplained.com.
Islam what? Islam what?
It's explained.
Explained?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
.com.
Okay.
I hope you can do it in English, but people can do it in Arabic too. And also there is, if you have questions, because I know you. you like to understand about these stuff, and I really appreciate you so much. The other thing is questions at islamexplained.com.
Okay, so it's islamexplained.com is the website. And is this a website that Muslim people are explaining to people like us what Islam is about?
Well, no, it's a guy. He was a Muslim, and
he's a Christian website then. Okay.
Uh huh. And it's so beautiful.
Okay.
Because he knows both. It's like Mark Gabriel. Also, he knows he was a Muslim. He taught Islam, memorized, and then he became a Christian, and that's why Mark Gabriel can really explain both. Why he?
I see. That's good.
Mm-hmm. And then the other
that's good.
One.
I've turned there.
What?
I've turned there, and it's all in Arabic. It looks like. Maybe they have it in English also.
Nothing. So how about questions at islamexplained.com? Maybe they can accept English.
Okay.
The email.
Okay. Questions at islamexplained.com.
Yes.
Okay.
I hope.
Okay. I think Christians definitely need to become much more, fluent in Islamic thought, because we're facing it all the time.
Yes, exactly. And all Mark Gabriel's books are really good. He has it in English and in Arabic too.
Okay, now that book was that book called Jesus and Muhammad, or was that what it's called?
I think so. Yes, not in front of me, but the author is Mark Gabriel, and he almost was gonna die and. Because he turned from Islam to Christianity, he used to teach Islam, and then when he studied the history, he just felt this cannot be God, and it's not the same God, because most of the people thought it's the same God of Islam and God of Christianity, but it's not, because the God of our God is the God of love. And you know, it's just a big difference.
Yes.
Christianity God is a God of love. Like Jesus said, you heard eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I am telling you, love your enemy.
Yes, he did say that. And that is a difference between Jesus and the God of Muhammad. Now, Sue, do you have an Islamic background yourself, or are you just studying this to be equipped?
No, just I always Christian, but praise God, I become a spirit filled, and now when I listen to these kind of programs, I understand more, because when I was little, they used to tell us that the God of Islam and the God of Christianity is the same, but now the picture is so clear, it's not the same. And even I love Muslim people, but they are deceived. That's the point.
Yes. Well, that's why we need to learn more about what they're thinking, so that we know how to communicate with them. You know, Sue, the music is playing, and that means I'm out of time.
Okay.
But I do appreciate your call and the recommendation.
Sure. I was driving, and I drove very fast to catch you before the show was over. Yes.
Well, you caught us.
Okay.
All right. God bless you, sister.
God bless you, too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now. All right. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and this program is live from 2 to 3 daily, Monday through Friday. That's Pacific time, to 2 to 3 in the afternoon. We are on the radio at that time. We're on the Internet live and later. You can catch the program live on the Internet, or you can listen to the program later on the archives at our website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com, just like the name of the program, The Narrow Path. If you'd like to help us pay our radio bills, which are considerable month by month, the address you can write to is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That address again is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. If you want that address and weren't able to get it just now, you can find that as well as many resources free to you at our website, thenarrowpath.com. I want to remind our Santa Cruz listeners
why
that we will be having
me?
Meetings.
I'll never know. Why does she work late every night?
Marriage. What happens when the joy